Hello, readers. My name is Jason Jeffries, and I am your host for Bookin', presented by Quail Ridge Books, Raleigh, North Carolina's trusted community bookstore. My guest today is William T. Volman, the author of more than 20 books, works of journalism, history and philosophy, process narratives, and collections of photographs. These works include the 3,352-page Rising Up and Rising Down, the Wonderful Book of Dolores, the National Book Award-winning novel Europe Central, the Seven Dreams series, which includes most recently The Dying Grass, Whores for Gloria, Writing Towards Everywhere, and most recently Carbon Ideologies, published by Viking Press, a two-volume work, these volumes being No Immediate Danger and No Good Alternative, that examines the various ideologies surrounding climate change. Bill, welcome to the program.
Jason, I'm happy and grateful to be seeing you again.
Thanks, Bill. I want to start by asking you about Carbon Ideologies. In the first volume, No Good Alternative, you spend most of your time on the page in Japan, specifically in the area in and around the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster. This was a disaster in 2011 that followed an earthquake and a tsunami, the consequences of which led to three nuclear meltdowns, hydrogen air explosions, and the release of radioactive materials into the environment. You traveled to Japan to speak with its citizens about the fallout and their experiences dealing with such. Two things. One, thank you for doing this. And two, what were you thinking?
Well, I love Japan. Japanese culture figures in some of my books, especially my book about No and geishas, Kissing the Mask. And I felt really sad and horrified when this accident happened. I've always had a lot of concern about nuclear power. When I was in college, I was in an affinity group which tried to blockade and occupy a nuclear plant then under construction in Seabrook, New Hampshire. Needless to say, we failed. We were nonviolent and were accused of violence, and I saw the police macing people and beating them. So it was par for the course. As I've gotten older, watch my little girl Lisa grow up into a woman, I've started thinking more and more about what the world will be like for the next generation. And I accepted the idea of climate change with a great deal of resistance because it's such an awful idea. You know, and as Gore said, it really is an inconvenient truth. But once I was convinced of the reality of this theory, then I started wondering what, if anything, we can do about it. And one of the reasons that my Carbon Ideologies is such a gloomy book is that I believe it's almost certainly too late. One thing I didn't know until I began working with a guy from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, you know, who has been studying this for many years, is that even if we were to desist from our carbon emissions today, the planet would continue to warm for up to 7,000 more years. The seas would keep rising. It's quite dire. So that made me want to reconsider nuclear power. And in all the years before the accident, my Japanese friends like to say, you know, Bill, you Americans, you keep doing these terrible things with coal and oil and so forth, and we're so much better than you are. We have this nuclear power. What really surprised me is that the Japanese, unlike Americans, are not really complainers. For them, and in this way, they're somewhat like the way Germans used to be too. They believe in extreme loyalty to the leadership. So one of my taxi drivers, the first time I was going into a red zone, explained to me that in his opinion, TEPCO, you know, the utility at fault, had done what they did for the nation. And you know, you can certainly cast it that way. Most people all over the world are extremely ignorant about science, and that is one of the reasons that these profit-driven corporations have been able to whittle away our future. In the case of TEPCO, I found when I interviewed, among others, a guy who used to work there and had ties with the senior management because they had all been in the same original class. There was a backup generator designed to continue to operate if a tsunami damaged anything else. And one of the ironies of nuclear power is that it takes an immense amount of fossil fuels to create the nuclear fuel and then to have backup power to keep it running. So this fossil fuel backup generator was not situated high enough, and that was because they wanted to cut their costs. It was an act, you might say, of negligence, although when I interviewed several of the TEPCO executives, I ended up feeling a lot of sympathy for them. They said that in their experience, you know, no tsunami had ever been as high as the one on 311. And so they thought they had done their due diligence, and that's the human condition. All the time, I think I've done my due diligence, and then it turns out I should have gone the extra mile. So it was a very strange situation with my really feeling sorry for everybody, except after a while, the Japanese government. No immediate danger comes from what they were constantly saying. They would announce the radioactive weather on television and on the radio, and they would constantly employ different units. So, you know, there are so many sieverts, that's the background radiation, and so many trillion becquerels were released into the ocean yesterday. And so even for someone with a little bit of scientific background, it's actually quite difficult to convert from becquerels to sieverts and so forth. And for most people, it's just meaningless. They can't actually understand it. And so the government would constantly say, oh yeah, there's no immediate danger, so don't worry. And that's true. There is a long-term horrendous danger, and it was year by year, it became more eerie and ultimately frightening to go into these abandoned localities as the radioactive bore started going in and out of these buildings. The weeds grew up and died and grew up and died, the windows broken, everything dark, goldenrod higher than you and I, pampas grass waving really, really beautifully, everything just so strange. It's almost like that Tarkovsky movie, Stalker. So at times it was a surprisingly beautiful experience, but it was also just kind of vile and sickening.
Thank you, Bill. I'm a voracious reader, and partly because I love your work and partly because of the length of your books, I'm certain that I've spent more time inside your head than any other writer who has ever lived. And I must admit, as I was reading Volume 1 of Carbon Ideology's No Immediate Danger, I found myself worrying about you. You spend a lot of time walking through areas that you probably shouldn't have been walking through, which of course is no surprise to anyone who has read you before. but something you did is, if the person who was guiding you through a particular region declined to wear any sort of protective suit or materials, then you also decline to wear any sort of protective suit or materials. Can you tell us about this decision and then a little bit more about your journeys through these restricted areas?
The first time I went into a red zone, I had brought basic safety equipment, you know, some masks and disposable outerwear and shoe covers and so on and so forth for my interpreter and me. That was about the most I could carry. So, you know, here we were with this poor taxi driver who believed that TEPCO had done what it had done for the nation and who would say things like, "Now, what is radiation? Is it a liquid? Does it make you itch?" We got to this place and I realized, you know, I hadn't brought anything for him. And I was ashamed. And I thought, here's somebody who trusts me as he trusted his leadership. And, you know, I am not going to ever, ever do anything that I wouldn't ask somebody else to do. And the people who would go back to their old homes and didn't want to wear any mask or anything like that, maybe they were habituated to it and no longer felt any fear, but it was on my account that they were going there. And so it would only be right that if something happened to them, it happened to me too. And in a way, I'm disappointed that this cancer I have is colon cancer, because all I can blame on that probably is my love of alcohol and smoked meat. If I had gotten lung or thyroid cancer, then I would have said, "All right, now I'm a hero." But it is what it is.
The Bookin' Podcast is sponsored by Libro FM Audiobooks. Libro FM lets you purchase audiobooks directly from your favorite local bookstore, Quail Ridge Books. You can pick from more than 100,000 audiobooks, including New York Times bestsellers and recommendations from booksellers around the country. With Libro.fm, you'll get the same audiobooks at the same price as the largest audiobook company out there. You know the name, but you'll be part of a much different story, one that supports community. Listeners of Bookin' can get a 3-month audiobook membership for the price of one. Go to Libro.fm, that's Libro.fm, and enter Bookin', Bookin, in the promo code space. With each listen, take pride in knowing that you're supporting local bookstores. Thank you, Bill. Volume 2 of Carbon Ideology's No Good Alternative spends some time in the United States of America, specifically in West Virginia, where coal is still taken very seriously by a large portion of the population. You spent a good amount of time in Nitro, West Virginia, which is where my father and his family are from.
Oh, is that right?
It is. Can you tell us about Nitro and what you found there and in the other regions of West Virginia?
Well, I would say the most spectacular tourist attraction of Nitro is the John Amos power plants. And you just see these billowing white clouds of coal smoke. What really surprised me was that it didn't stink. And that's one of the interesting things about the nuclear accident. Well, what is it? Is it a liquid? Does it itch? I don't feel it, so it must be okay. And about global warming itself, carbon dioxide is invisible. You know, the warming has taken place very, very inconspicuously. And so, you know, for the ordinary street smart person who has been able to do quite well using his own senses, it seems very reasonable to say, "Well, I don't see any problem, so why should I worry about global warming?" I went to a lady's house in Nitro, right up against the coal plant and asked her how she felt. And she said, well, and this is what I hear from people all over the world in other contexts. Well, I've lived here all my life and I'm used to it. I don't see anything wrong with it. The other thing on that subject is I have something called a pancake frisker, which allows real-time measurements of radiation. And it served me very, very well in Fukushima. I would find out, this grating or drain pipe right here is very, very dangerous. But if I step away, I'm fine, you know. I had heard that there were some radioactive emissions in coal smoke because all the heavy metals, which get concentrated into the roots of the plants, which eventually become coal, may well, you know, have a radioactive component. And I couldn't measure any radiation at all. It was just too subtle for my pancake frisker. And carbon ideologies, among other things, is really a record of my failures. It's a record of all human failures, too, to address this crisis. But, you know, here was I, very, very motivated, reasonably intelligent, prepared to spend my own money on measurement. And I couldn't begin to make all the measurements it would have taken. You know, with coal alone, there were probably 20 or 30 things that needed to be measured. The electrical resistance in streams, the heavy metal content of soil, all kinds of things that I couldn't hope to do. And so I would say that, what I took away from Nitro was how easy it would be for people to stay with preconceived conclusions.
Thank you, Bill. We're sitting here in Raleigh, North Carolina, where you were appearing at the North Carolina Book Festival for the second time. And the first time you were here in 2014, there was a coal ash, quote unquote, spill that was in the news quite a lot here in Raleigh. Did you investigate that at all?
A little bit. That was another of my failures. I tried to follow the river. I went, I think it was to the town of Eden. People were concerned. I knocked on some doors and they said, yeah, sometimes the river looks yellow and we're kind of afraid to drink it, but we don't really know what to do. And I kept following the river and people seemed to know less and less. And finally I got to a town where everyone said, no, what are you talking about? We haven't heard anything about this spill. I remember reading, you know, that it was going to take an immense amount of money to restore the river. Because when this coal ash hits, it kills almost everything instantly. And then it stays and stays and stays. And so Duke Energy got off with, what in absolute terms sounded like a high fine. But it was a very small percentage of what needed to be done, and they made the usual blather about, oh, well, now we've learned our lesson and we're sure we'll be able to give even better service in the future. The typical pronouncement of a carbon ideologue who's also a CEO.
Yeah, thank you, Bill. Another place you visited in Volume 2 of Carbon Ideologies is the United Arab Emirates, which is a very secretive country. Can you describe for our listeners what you found there?
Well, it was a riot. There was one place that had an ATM that poops out solid gold bars. So if you were a sheikh and you wanted to impress three or four girlfriends, here, darling, you know, have some gold, put in the credit card. inside these resorts and malls and so forth, vast amounts of oil were being burned. There was one mall that had an open air skating rink. So you could look down from another level and have a coffee and watch people skating on the ice, you know, and there might be a sweet Muslim girl wearing a t-shirt that said, "No boyfriend, no drama." Everyone happy. And outside, you know, it might be 100 degrees and really humid. So I did some calculations on how much oil needed to be burned just to keep that ice frozen. It was kind of shocking. The use of oil in the Emirates, the per capita use, is even higher than in the U.S. They are, as you say, rather secretive, and so I imagine it wouldn't be that great for my health to go back there, because all pictures of refineries were strictly forbidden, and somehow my finger kept accidentally tripping on the shutter all the time. And I would interview these guest workers because my interpreter was a Rajasthani. We tended to look for people from Rajasthan and India. And they had a pretty rough life. They would live in these guest houses that would be ethnically segregated. And most of them were either in the guest house or at work. They would work more and get overtime so they could go back to their country sooner. They couldn't really wander around. Sometimes the company would keep their ID. And then if they were caught without the ID, really bad things could happen. Emiratis get paid much, much more for the same position than the guest workers. You know, some of these people from different countries said, as one guy named Gilbert, I think he was from Cameroon, he said, "Well, you know, Mr. William, compared to what I come from, this is not so bad." And it's true. They were making money to send back to their families, but the oil there is very high sulfur. And it just had a nasty, nasty smell. And a lot of the guys were complaining about feeling sick all the time. It must have been extremely bad for them. Some of them understood global warming. Most people, of course, didn't. I really liked everyone I met, as I always do. I talked with some higher level guest workers. People from Kazakhstan and so forth who'd been trained as engineers. They felt pretty good about the work they were doing. And that was another thing that I had to accept. I was lucky enough to interview in the U.S. the former CEO of Conoco and also a vice president of the Bank of Oklahoma in charge of energy loans. And I really respected and liked both of these men, and listened to their own personal accounts of struggling up from very, very little and getting to play with all of these fantastic oil industry toys. And I thought, yeah, I would love to have that kind of power and say, well, all right, let's drill to 5,000 feet and set off some explosives and see what we can find. And oh, look, now we have a gusher and everyone's going to be so happy. And it's not their fault that suddenly the consensus seems to be that oil is really, really dangerous for our planet. What are they supposed to do? And the carbon ideologues who say that these guys are all criminals are as mistaken as the fossil fuel shills who say, oh, stay away from those horrible green socialists. We have to burn more and more fossil fuels for the sake of prosperity. The only way that we have any hope of a future is to try to work together with everyone and say, all right, say you oil guys, what can we do so that you can go on making a decent living and we can help everyone? Maybe that means in the short term, we would have to make solar some kind of utility. So we consumers would go on paying through the nose every month. We wouldn't be allowed to own our own solar collectors, at least for a while. So these guys could be paid off and shown respect for what they've done. I feel that way about the people in West Virginia too. They have been so disdained and exploited. And they really, really feel that the rest of us have just taken from them. And they have, as they always like to say, they've kept our lights on. You know, they helped win the victory in World War II because of all the coal for steel and so forth. And suddenly we're saying we're going to shut down their coal industry and leave them high and dry. That was, I think, one of Hillary's most stupid mistakes. So that's how I feel about these people in the Emirates, too. The Emirates would obviously be a natural place for solar. And if only we could help people to see that. You know, again, solarizing the entire world tomorrow is not going to be enough because of our 7,000-year window for continued warming. But it would certainly be a start. And the only way to do it, I think, is to show kindness and consideration for everyone on the other side.
Listeners, we are going to pause here. I sat down for a 20-minute interview with Bill Volman that soon turned into a 90-minute interview, the first half of which you just heard. We discussed his carbon ideologies. The second half of the interview, which we will air next week, Bill and I discuss every other book he has written over his long and illustrious career. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.